Good morning and welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. I'm Amy Otto, joined by Lee Cantor. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning, Miss Amy. How are you doing today?
I'm great.
Spring is in the air.
Oh, I love it.
Fired up about
it. I love it.
And you promised me no more cold weather, right?
Yeah, I can only hope.
Can you do that?
Yeah, I'm thinking I might plant my garden a little early this year.
Feeling lucky, huh?
Yeah, I've got the seeds going. We'll see. I'll
really?
Have to give you an update. Yeah. My whole guest room. I hope nobody comes to visit me because I've got the lights and the whole thing is set up with all my seeds.
It's a risk, though. Everybody does it a little premature and then it frosts and then you get bummed out and you get to do it again.
Yeah, no.
But you love gardening.
So I do.
Good. But I wanted to talk about a little bit. We just started a new partnership with the BMA, the Business Marketing Association of Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of that?
I have,
Been to any of their meetings, I think, in Maggiano's?
I have been to. It's been a while, but I've been to theirs.
Well, they're doing the 7th annual BMA Atlanta Charity Chocolate Tasting.
Mmm.
You ever been to one of those?
I have.
So what happens? I've never been.
A lot of chocolate, a lot of tasting, and a lot of love. I think a couple years ago, it was before Valentine's Day, and I remember going with some friends, and it was a great event.
Yeah, this one is at the French American Brasserie. Have you been there? FAB?
Nope.
And chocolates, drinks, snacks, raffles, auctions, and it all benefits the Cure Childhood Cancer.
Great organization. Yeah.
What do they do?
Cure. Yeah.
They do the research or they do the...
They put money towards research, yeah.
Nice.
And they're local. They're actually, I think their headquarters is in Sandy Springs, so...
Oh, cool. So grassroots?
Yes. I hope to go. I really enjoyed it, and there were so many different kinds of chocolates, and I love chocolates.
Yeah. Who doesn't?
Yes.
And so you got to go to the website, bmaatlanta.com/events. You can see it there and register. And the event is February 24th, 6 to 8.
Excellent. We've got great guests this morning, Lee. They're all over the board, which I like that. I'd like to mix it up.
Variety.
And our listeners are in for a treat because we have success stories. We have lots of different businesses and a lot of hot tips. Our first guest this morning, welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show. We have Randy Merrill. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell us about your business. Sounds like you've got a lot of them.
Well, we do. By necessity. We started in the health and fitness business with tanning salons in 1990. We're now the largest chain here in the city of Atlanta, Solar Dimensions. And we really started to branch out several years ago. We did Planet Smoothie at one time. We have a Cartridge World now, and we're getting ready to launch Massage Heights, which is the second largest chain in the country of massage franchises. And that's where we are.
So you've done some concepts that you started and originated
that
and some
correct.
That you purchased?
That's right. We started in 1990 with Super Bodies, which morphed into Maui Tan and then into Solar Dimensions.
So can you speak a little about that? Because those are two different, you know, kind of forks in the road. Some people decide, hey, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm going to figure this all out on my own. And the other people are like, you know what? I want someone else to have the learning curve and I'll just jump on as a franchisee.
Well, it was, it was an easy transition from fitness into tanning. And you didn't really have any national players. So it was easy to build yourself. There was no real guidelines. There was no franchise book, if you will, to go to. So it was out of necessity that we did it ourselves. And as you go through those things, you realize that, geez, wouldn't it be nice to have a roadmap? And so that was the transition into the franchises. Let someone else do the legwork and let us drive the wheel.
And when you went into the franchising business, how do you come up with the plan, and then how does that duplicate itself in the other markets? Is it really strict as to what people can have, what the stores look like? I mean, walk us through how you went about that.
Yeah, it is very strict, or at least it should be. The Planet Smoothie, we got in at the very beginning when it started, and they went through a lot of changes. So you had to change your decor, a lot of growing pains with that. So that was a great lesson for us at that time. The Massage Heights was much more mature than the Planet Smoothie was at the time, as well as Cartridge World. And there hasn't been much change. You follow their plan, and then you go work very hard.
Is it all about location? I know we've had some franchise owners on from Massage Heights,
yes.
Cartridge World.
Yes.
We've had a lot of franchise people on lately.
I know.
It's cool, though, because I think it's an inspiration to the entrepreneurs that listen, because everybody wants to be a business owner in
yes.
some respect. And it does sound like with the economy, small business loans are yes. easier to get.
Well, not yet. They're still pretty challenging.
Really?
As a matter of fact, in 2009, you could couldn't get any money at all, basically. Even if you had money, it was very challenging. It's opened up a little bit, but the requirements are very strict. You know, when you go to 08 and before, it was easy to get money. You could go to get money on your house, 401k. You can't get that anymore. Those lines of credit are not available. So the players that are coming into the market now are people that are buying 2, 3, and 5 stores. Maybe they own 10 Denny's or 10 tanning salons, and they're coming in and buying multiples of these franchises. It's very challenging for the individual owner out there. Of course, that is loosening up a little bit.
Just speak to a little bit, is it easier if you're getting funding for a franchise since it's already a proven business model as opposed to any other business?
Absolutely.
Okay.
If it's on the SBA-approved lender, then it's certainly much easier. But the qualifications are still pretty heavy. About 30% down is what you have to have, and then you have to collateralize basically the whole amount. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got to have some resources. You can't just go with the dream and a few thousand dollars. So it's a little more challenging these days.
Do you find people like putting their 401ks in there?
Well, you know, they've been hit so hard that very few people bring that to the table. And then the house is the same way. So those people have dried up. One of our competitors opened multiple, almost 20 stores in a area, and 15 of those people did 401ks or their houses is collateral. So those kinds of people don't exist to buy franchises anymore. It's a different model, it would seem.
I see you have a relationship with Tom Gustav, and he's the one that was a guest.
Yes.
Early on with Massage Heights. Talk a little bit about how the Massage Heights franchise is different from the competitors.
Well, it's more of a spa-like experience. It's a much higher end at a value proposition. So it's a membership that's $49 a month. You get a one-hour massage. You get aromatherapy. You never lose that. It rolls over. And so it's bringing a higher quality of service to the table for the same dollar or actually a little bit less. We're not trying to be the cheapest. We're just trying to be the most value-pointed proposition that's out there.
And then how often do you find people come back for massage? Is it weekly, monthly?
It's about, you know, you have your different clientele, but in general it's about 1.4 a month that a client will come in on the average. Mm-hmm. So you have some, you know, myself, I try to go weekly to stress relief. Mm-hmm. Others once a month. Others, you know, we'll do a two-hour massage every other month, something like that. But what we find is the mass population is just pounding the doors down to get in. We live in a place of high stress, and they're looking for releases, and we offer that.
And it sounds like you're looking to open 20 locations around the Atlanta market.
That is correct.
How do you go about that? I mean, do you look at real estate, or do you travel, like look at the traffic volume? Or
absolutely. We use Buxton. It's a demographic report. We use that as a base, but being a native Atlantan, I'm familiar with really, I can tell you, the first 10 that we'll be opening up. You know, we'll be in Brookhaven, we'll be in Vinings, we'll be in Smyrna. So we know the ideal locations area-wise, but then we try to pinpoint into a Publix or a really good anchor is our main idea.
I know the one in Sandy Springs is by a Publix, and that is a great location. Yes. How do you get people in, though? I mean, what type of marketing strategies are you using?
Mostly it is the internet drives the large proportion in. We also do guys in the street with signs. I mean, we do guerrilla marketing. We go to all levels, but we try to stay within those realms without doing a lot of direct mail pieces. Those end up being a lot more costly per client or phone call, if you will, that comes in. So we go guerrilla, we go internet, and we go street sign.
So the guy with the gorilla outfit?
Wow. Yeah. More of a Roman outfit.
It's Roman.
Spa-like. That's right.
That's what he did.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, how about the economy? I know massage and certain things are considered a luxury item,
yes.
Although...
Well, I guess this is affordable, right? Your price point's affordable.
Absolutely. And that's the whole thing, is that it's not a luxury. It's really...
It's like a nice treat.
Absolutely. It's quality of life,
right.
Actually, is the way we try to look at it. And what we saw was in 08, January of 08, we had a huge drop in business in the tanning. And it was a precursor to what was going to happen. What we've seen now is our sales are back up. And so we feel like it's a precursor to the economy itself. So we expect good days ahead. We've had record numbers. The Sandy Springs store is the third top producing store in the whole system throughout the country. So we're producing at a high level, and we don't feel like it's a luxury. We feel like it's a necessity in life to relieve the stress.
I got to ask, do you mind talking about vitamin D?
Absolutely. Love to.
Because, you know, it's funny. I thought 10 years ago when you see kids in front of the computer and everybody's lathering on the sunscreen all the time, I love to be outside. And there's a lot to be said for vitamin D.
Absolutely.
But I don't know how it relates to the tanning business. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. Well, you know, one of the things that doesn't make any sense is when you say you've got to have vitamin D, the children are getting rickets, we've got to get back out in the sun. The indoor sun is cleaner than the outdoor sun. If you're going to lather up, as you said, and go out and try to get that vitamin D without getting all of the other harmful rays, you know, that doesn't seem like a very good value proposition in the long term. So what we say is you come in, you get a controlled amount of vitamin A and UVA and UVB. So it's a controlled time-wise and amount of UVA and UVB exposure. So you don't have to really be a scientist to know that if you can do it in a controlled environment, it's much cleaner, much safer. You know, I have a five-year-old, and when he turns 16 and the whole high school thing and wants to go out and lay in the sun, you know, we won't allow that. But at that point, I would allow him to get in the tanning bed because it's clean, safe sun. You do get your vitamin D from it. And, you know, I feel like that at some point it will go in the reverse way and they'll come back and go, my goodness, everybody needs sun. Let's get in the beds. So that's our standpoint. I mean, you get the vitamin D, it's clean and it's safe. It doesn't make any sense to go out in the real sun to get your vitamin D.
Did you know there was such a thing as clean sun, Lee?
No, I didn't.
Now you do.
Now you
new,
do.
New to
learn,
me.
Clean
learn
sun.
Learn something every day.
That's right.
All right. So let our listeners know, maybe what's one thing that you've learned through this whole journey that you can share with them, whether it's an up or a down? I mean, our listeners love to hear stories, especially success stories. Maybe there's that person out there that's thinking, I'd love to leave my corporate job.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to own a franchise. What kind of advice would you have for them?
Well, I would tell them to go work in the industry for a year beforehand. And, you know, the part of owning your own business is you carry it 365 days a year. You carry it 24 hours a day. There's no break. You know, there's a lot to be said for having a nice corporate job. You know, it's a lot of responsibility. And I just always suggest you work in the industry for a year before you make any kind of a decision. And the other part is you have other people's lives and families' lives at stake when you open your own business. So you need to be prepared for that.
Now, would you, moving forward, would you open more franchises or would you originate your own concepts?
No, I will definitely build the Massage Heights brand. Turning 50, I think this is my last hurrah. We'd like to get these 20 stores out in the next 48 months. We have a plan in place for that. We have the financing. And we have people knocking our doors down right now to get franchises. So there's no shortage of growth in this.
That's great.
Cool.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Absolutely.
I love when there are businesses that are thriving.
Absolutely. The economy is on its way back, and it is going to be led by the service sector.
It'll be no by tanning and spas, right?
That's right. Randy Merrill leading the way. That is correct.
It's so true, especially in Atlanta. Like, we had a guest last week that was talking about when he came to America, one of the first things he noticed was all the cereal in the grocery store and then how white women's teeth were. And then as we were walking out, he elaborated more. He's like, you know, people just take care of themselves differently here.
That's right.
And there's a lot to be said for taking care of yourself.
Yeah. Really, if you don't take care of yourself, no one else will. We feel that if by getting sun, massage, these things make you feel better. I can tell you for a fact of 20 years in the industry, you can physically watch people come in, get in the tanning bed, and leave with a better attitude and a better spirit. You don't have to have scientific knowledge to see that, but scientific knowledge does back that up. So it's great. It's awesome.
Good. That's why he's smiling.
Yeah.
Thanks, Randy. Thanks for being our guest today.
Let's get some websites of where people can learn more.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the website is Massage Heights Atlanta.com. That's correct. And you can reach us in Buckhead at 404-846-0444. That's our newest location in the Peach Public Shopping Center, Barnes & Noble. And it's going to be a phenomenal facility. Please come see us.
Great. Cool. Thanks for being our guest today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
We got to catch up with Tom again. I haven't seen him in a while. Yeah, sometimes I'll be driving through the parking lot and I'll see him inside Massage Heights. Uh-huh. But they're so busy, there's no place to park. They're just hopping.
Yeah, that changed that whole dynamic of the shopping center.
Yeah, it really has. That's nice. I love to see that. Our next guest this morning, Abraham Seong. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show.
It's great to be here, Amy. Thank you for having me.
We're kind of shifting gears now. So you're with Government Contractors, the Government Contractors Association. Tell us what that's all about.
Government Contractors Association is an organization that supports businesses in the government market. Mm-hmm. And what we realize is that there's so much opportunities in the government market, and there's not enough support. There's over 31 million businesses in the U.S., according to the Census 2007, but only 181,000 companies are winning government contracts. And so we exist to support small business and large business so they can enter into the government market.
So you help them get a government contract? Is that what you do?
Our primary focus is to educate them so they can go and win government contracts.
Do you think it's like if a person just had no idea and they just went to the government website, they'd never be able to figure it out, or it would be difficult?
There are maze and maze and layers of information, and most businesses get into the government market thinking that they're going to go and win a government contract within 3 months or 6 months.
Right.
It takes about 36 months to lay a solid foundation.
36 months. Three years.
3 years.
You're kidding me.
I'm absolutely serious. That's why so few businesses are in the government market. Now, think about this. Your government market has been around since someone said, let's get our independence. The first shot was fired. Let's go out there. We need volunteers. And so
we need now guns.
Yes,
right?
We need guns. We need all these different things. But today, the government is the largest consumer in the world. They award over $500 billion in government contracts to the commercial sector. But less than half of 1% of businesses are doing work for the government.
Wow.
Is it one of those things where once you get in there, then you're in for life kind of thing?
Yes. Once you in, it's hard to break in, but once you're in, you become the incumbent, and they love you, and you will continue to be successful, and you can grow exponentially in the government market because the contract size in the government market has a lot more zeros than the commercial sector.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Do you think that this is bad for the economy, though?
No. Yeah. It's good for the economy because most businesses that are suffering in the commercial sector, why not deal with the largest consumer in the world? Mm-hmm. They are the largest consumer in the world, and so you can't ignore the government market.
But it's scary.
I'm afraid just talking to you. 3 years, I don't even know. How do I know what's going to happen 3 years?
Well, that's why we exist. We exist because we want to shrink that time to 12 to 6 months to 12 months.
Really?
But I understand. I mean, I understand the longevity and why that would be important. But say I'm a small business owner and I'm obviously a woman. Mm-hmm. I know that's
an advantage, right?
Yes, being a woman business owner's advantage.
So between me and her, she has an advantage, right? We have the same exact product. She would have an edge over me.
Well, she's a lot better looking than you, she has an edge because of that.
But being a woman, is that an advantage over if a man and a woman are going two companies, one owned by a man, one owned by a woman, does a woman have an advantage?
Not necessarily, but the woman does have special set-asides.
Woman.
Well, just being a woman, there are special set-asides to support women in business. Let me tell you a little bit about the statistics as it relates to the government market.
Yeah.
There's women business represents over 41% of business in America. But in terms of government contracts, dollars that's going to women businesses, only 3.68% of contracts are being won by women businesses. And so the government recognized that that is a serious problem. And so what they want to do is they've got to address that. And so they create a special set-aside program specifically to support women businesses because they know that if they don't support women businesses, there is an inequality that's happening, and there's been a historical pattern because in 1979, 0.2% of contracts are going to women businesses. Mm. And, you know, 40 years later, we're at 3.68%. And so they do have
Yeah.
It's getting better, but woman represents 41%, and they're only getting 3.68%.
Right. Lee, I would need to be your front woman.
Yeah. Can we do that?
Yes, that's a very good strategy in doing government contract. Because if you have a friend or if you're married, 51%, if it's owned by the woman, the government says that qualifies for the special set-aside.
Really? Oh, so you help with those kind of strategies?
Yes, we develop a whole strategy so that you can go into the government market, not just blindly trying to figure out what this 36 months going to be like for you. And so we reduce that time frame through our coaching program, through our educational webinars, through our educational seminars and training classes, so that women businesses or any other business can go out there and really focus on winning government contracts.
Now, when you're working with them, do you have to sometimes kind of tweak their business to make it fit into what the government needs? Or do they, you know, you just say, okay, I sell widgets, so the government doesn't have a need for my widgets. Do you go, hey, you know what? If you change your widgets a little, you might be able to get this program over here.
Every business has a different strategy in the government market. So, yes, we do talk to them in regards to their specific strategy, because every business is unique. And so, for example, if it's a business that comes in and they're a women-owned business, we talk about, okay, these are the different 83 industries that the government says these are especially underrepresented by women businesses.
Right.
And so we teach them what they are so that they can go and have the right product and services to support the government market.
Wow. So how do you get started, and who are the largest winners in this market? I mean, are they people that have just – that's all their businesses now? I mean, or is it a hybrid?
I want to be on the radio this morning because I wanted to address a new program to support women businesses.
Great.
It just came out the month of October, and it officially launches in February, which is this month here. And so I thought that, you know, I want to expose the women businesses in America. Now, there's a lot of great programs for other different groups out there that are substantially underrepresented in the government market. But women businesses have this is a unique time to be a business owner and be a woman. Because the new program says, the government says that 5% of all federal spending should go to women businesses. So $537 billion, which is the total federal spending, $27 billion of that, they wanted to go to women businesses. Hmm. And so this new program is called Economically Disadvantaged Women-Owned Small Businesses. And so to get started, first you have to assess your business to see if the government market is right for you.
Mm-hmm.
Second, once you realize that it is the right market, then you have to actually put a strategy together. And we help you develop those strategies so that you can actually go out there and implement it.
Okay.
And then as you implement it, then we talk about all the registration process,
mm-hmm.
because there's different, you know, databases that you have to be in. There's different registration point. You got to get your DUNS number, be in the main government contracting database.
Right.
And then we teach you how to find the right opportunities and we teach you how to write proposals, because proposal can be a very challenging thing.
I bet.
Is this super expensive? Like how much would it cost to, okay, I'm going to go in. I do internet radio and podcasting. Okay. That's what my business is. So I want to get a government contract. The paperwork I have to fill out? Is there a lot of money I have to spend in signing up for these government programs and getting the application fees and all the rigmarole to get this going?
You're making up words.
It sounds complex.
It does.
Complexity scares me. You know, I like things simple. So is this something, because I'm going to invest at least 6 months, 12 months, and, you know, if I didn't have Abraham, it would be 3 years of my life trying to do this.
Right.
So is it tens of thousands of dollars to get this going?
There's a few ways to get started in government contracting. The one way is to hire someone who has experience in the government market, who's been a contracting officer, who's worked on the government side, and hire them into your corporation so that you mm-hmm. can use their expertise to take your private sector company back into the public sector.
Okay, I'll
do
that.
That's very expensive. Someone who's qualified will charge you about $150,000 a year to come and help you develop that as part of your employee.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So most businesses can't afford that there.
Right.
Or you can go hire a consultant mm-hmm. on a part-time basis, and they will help you to develop it. Or you can join an association like Government Contractors Association, where we utilize the resources of multiple different groups out there and multiple different consultants and different expertise out there, so that we can put together a coaching program so that we can support business. And our coaching program is very affordable. It's just a few hundred dollars a month.
Now, but this is something where you're just helping me do it. You're not doing it.
Yes. Because if we were going to do it, it's going to cost you $150,000 a year.
Right. So you can train one of my employees to do it.
Our focus is to teach you how to fish and not give you a fish.
Right.
Because in the government market, once you know how to fish, you can fish in that market because you can catch whales.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Your background is interesting. I mean, how did you go from launching Metro Furniture, an office furniture manufacturing company, to where you are now?
My background is from the commercial sector. Okay. And I've been in the government market for the last few years, and I really enjoy it. But I came here as a refugee from Laos, and mm-hmm. towards the end of the Vietnam War, when the country was taken over by the communist regime, we thought, my father said, you know, we cannot stay in this place. And so we came became refugees, came to America, was sponsored by a church to come to America, didn't speak any English, didn't know what snow was, because Laos is just rain. Mm-hmm. And so it was a culture environment shock, you know, a language shock. And, you know, we went through this whole transition, but I appreciate the opportunities we have in this country. And so because of that, I've been a lifelong entrepreneur. Started a small business when I was 18 years old, comic books, baseball cards, did mm-hmm. that. It was a lot of fun. And then eventually you decide, okay, you know what, I want to be a missionary for the rest of my life. Did mm-hmm. that for a while, came back to America, decided that I want to get back into business, took the $300 I had, opened up an office furniture company, and turned that into over $10 million in inventory and assets.
Wow.
Sold that business, got into real estate, and then did very well in real estate. Then something amazing happened. The market crashed.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know, what's next for me? Because, you know, I'm young. I've got a lot of things I want to do in life. And then along the way, I met someone from the government market. And so we mm-hmm. started talking. So we formed a company together, did consulting work in the government sector. And then I finally said, you know, I really want to support small businesses. And what's the best way to support small businesses? So I left that business to really start an association so we can support small businesses, not only just in Atlanta, but from a national perspective.
How old were you when you came here?
I was about 6.
Oh, so you were mm-hmm. a kid. So yes. You grew up here. So, because I was interested to get his perspective from last week. We had a guy that came from another country here, mm-hmm. from South Africa, and he was telling the story about seeing how different the people mm-hmm. were, and I just wanted your take on that. Did you, culturally, how was the change?
Oh, it you know, there's some great changes, and there's some things like I said, whoa, this is very different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the smallest thing, like flipping the light switch, because in Laos, the average person makes $300 a year.
Mm.
And so we don't know what a light switch is. We don't know what your flushing toilet is.
Right.
And so from these little things to like, wow, these so much opportunities in America, I can go out there and really be a business person mm-hmm. and succeed. And so that's the path that I've chosen.
Wow, yeah. That's great.
And it sounds like you're helping a lot of people along the way.
Yes, we're building a great association to support not only just women businesses, but mm-hmm. all businesses in America. And Atlanta is a great hub to do that because there's so many federal opportunities here, so much state and local opportunities here in our area here.
Has any of the people that are a part of the association had any luck in getting any government contracts yet?
The association is a new organization, and so we've been around for about, you know, 8 months, and so there's a cycle.
Sure.
And so we started taking on members, and we implemented our coaching program a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And so we've got some clients who are at a point where they're very close to win some contracts right now.
Right, but so they've applied, and they're in
yes.
the game, but they just haven't been
yes.
told yet.
Yeah, it takes about 3-4 months to ramp up, and then you can start pursuing government contracts.
Uh-huh. Hmm. Wonderful.
So how do people learn more?
Yeah, I was going to say, how do people learn more? And I mean, I know that there's a whole RFP process, and you have to, I mean, it's a whole different language in a whole different world. How does someone find you?
Yes, the language is called Governese. And so first we have to teach you a new language. Just like coming to America, I had to learn a new language.
Right.
So we have to teach that to business. But to really get started, one of the best places to find, whether it's our association or any other association, to start there and learn. But our association, I believe, is the best at serving the community. Mm-hmm. And so our website is govcontractors.org. Govcontractors.org is our website. We have a lot of great resources on there. And you can reach us also by phone at 404-955-8080.
And then on the website, it'll tell you, like, if you want to go to one of these seminars or conferences or, you know, get information, coaching, that's all there?
Yes, we have a lot of great conferences and a lot of great webinars and seminars regularly posted on our website so that businesses can come and get exposed to the government market.
And it's not just people in Atlanta. Anybody can find this and use this information?
Yes, everyone nationwide can access this information because government is not only just in our nation, but our government do spend money internationally.
Wonderful.
Wow. That's cool.
Yeah, thanks for being our guest this morning. Great information.
I know, well, really amazing.
Lee, Amy, it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Wow. You know, Lee, I think that it would take an association like that or a consultant to really kind of take away the scariness. Really.
I know.
I mean, it is. It's intimidating.
Right.
But it has, statistics are alarming when you think about that. I mean, think about the largest consumer is the government.
Right. And it's like you almost have to just take a shot and go yeah. for it a little.
Yeah, no doubt.
You do work with the government. Don't you?
Yeah, I do. I actually do a little bit. And it can be intimidating because the RFP process, I mean, you definitely, there's no room for creativity. Put it that way.
Right.
I'm an out-of-the-box thinker when it comes to answering those RFPs. There's no out-of-the-box thinking. Have to definitely dot my I's and cross my T's. Our next guest this morning, I've got a feeling that he knows how to dot his I's and cross his T's.
Welcome
to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, Robert Myring. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
As an attorney, I'm sure you probably are not as creative as some of the artistic folk we get, but you're very logical. Would I be right to say that? Are attorneys logical?
Well, it depends on who you're talking to.
Really. So let's talk about your services, and in particular, do you have a niche market that you service?
Well, yeah, there are a few niches, and when we put them all together, we end up being somewhat of a general practice, but those niches include full-service trust and estates, business creation support, as well as litigation, general litigation across the board.
So you talk about families' futures. How important is that? Wow. Amazing, too, about the statistics about how many people don't plan and don't have a will.
Well, yes. I think generally people do avoid conversations about their demise, more or less. But yet they'll go out and buy life insurance because it's very easy to do so. In the long run, you pay scores times more for life insurance than a person would do for an estate plan. Yet, far less than half the population has an estate plan, far more than half the population has life insurance, and they're both acquired for the same reason.
What, why is it important to have a will or an estate plan?
Well, with
I thought that's only for like rich people.
Well, no, it's for people who get married, have kids, people who get divorced. I believe that's again about half the population. So, we have a lot of blended families. And the parents who make money can do whatever they want with it, give it wherever they want. But if they never state what they want to do with their money and which family members they want to give it to, there's some default rules.
Some of the default rules that people aren't aware of?
That's called the intestate code. So somebody doesn't have a will, they pass away, they're intestate. And some of the default rules are just simply spouse passes away and then all the belongings of that spouse go to the surviving spouse as well as the surviving children. And there's, as you can tell, very intricate rules to that.
So it doesn't automatically just go exclusively to the other spouse?
Sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. If there's no children, of course, everything goes to the spouse.
Right, but if there's children, then it's divided amongst the spouse and the children?
It is. It is. Yet, if there's three children, if there's two children, right. Spouse and two children each get one third.
So then the kid can say, look, I want my third. I want to cash out and you got to give me.
Yes. If there's no will, if the child is truly the child of the deceased,
right.
Then yes, they can make a claim. And yet on the other side, the surviving spouse, whether male or female, does have a claim. It's called the It's called the spousal share mm-hmm. of the estate, and that the surviving spouse does have a right to it.
Well, Lee, there's a whole other language coming
rules.
In there, a whole different language. So I can understand why you would definitely want a lawyer to help.
So if you had a
will,
you can just make it kind of black and white in this area, right?
Well, yes, you'll know at least what's going to happen to your things in the long run, and what kind of a legacy you're going to leave behind. It's more than just money. It's what people remember you by.
Right.
So if you give your favorite nephew, some cheap heirloom, that's how they're going to remember you.
Right. Now, is this something you think because people maybe in America like have a weird relationship with death, so they don't like to deal with this?
Most people believe they're not going to die.
Is that what you found?
Yes. That's why they don't deal with
it. So intellectually, really? They know other people die. They just don't think they're personally going
to
die?
Right, right. There's no application of the concept of death to the self.
So you made the statement in some of the documentation you sent us that you think that Americans are overinsured and underplanned.
Mm. Oh, definitely. definitely. It's just the ease of buying a life insurance policy. You fill out an application, you get a blood test, you pay your monthly fee, and then you pass away, and hypothetically, money goes to your family.
Oh, so you think, in your head, you think, oh, I've done everything I can do, because there,
yes.
I wrote this check every month, and I've got them covered.
Right, but most people buy term life insurance, and most people outlive that term. They outlive their life expectancy, so that on term life insurance, the payoff, only about 2% of the insured actually have the benefits going to their family. The life insurance money would go to the family in 2% of the cases in term life insurance.
Interesting. Wow. So,
again, it doesn't pay off for 98%?
Well, it pays off for all the insurance companies.
So they're the big winners.
Yes, yes. And, well, I mean, no family is ahead when they lose a family member, of course. But
it's insurance. Like, you get life insurance just in case.
Right, right. But the very small amount that pays off, though it's good in that 2% of the times, it just illustrates that the planning of that sort covers that 2%. 98% is left open, and we just hope that they have an estate plan.
Right.
And you have to have an attorney or to have an estate plan?
No, you don't. You don't. You just have to be able to compose your will or your trust properly with the proper signing. There needs to be the proper number of people who sign, and it just needs to clearly state what that person's intent is. Who does that money or possessions go to?
But there's benefit in having an attorney, obviously.
Oh, yeah, sure. Peace of mind. Yeah. You know, attorneys, well, let me say, trust in the state's attorneys put together the estate plan in a very knowledgeable way. But I believe most attorneys, most of the populace has the idea that any attorney can put together a will. And though that may functionally be true, it may be dysfunctional. The will itself may be dysfunctional. It may not be signed properly, and it may leave a family or somebody intestate. That will is no good, so it's as good as not having one.
Oh, so like you think maybe, oh, I have a business attorney, so I'll just let him do my will because I already have a relationship, and you're saying that if he doesn't know all the ins and outs of this, it might kind of come back to bite you.
It could be a big mistake. It's not always a big mistake, but
what about like going to Office Depot and buying a will in the legal section?
Right? Well, some people do that, and sometimes it works out. And I want to emphasize that you can draft a will as long as you have some idea of what you want to say and you sign it correctly. And we hope that it would work in the probate court to be allowed to be used. But if there's somebody else, like a distant cousin with a claim on the estate, they look at the office store will and they get a good attorney. And that attorney should be able to pretty much disallow the will or just call it invalid.
Interesting.
That, yeah, so, they don't tell you that on those commercials with Robert Shapiro. He doesn't mention that.
No, he doesn't. So when I left you all those things on that napkin and I said, this goes to Lee Cantor. Right. How often does someone need to update their will? My grandmother died at 103 and recently. I'll tell you what. I think that needed some updating. Why am I laughing? I mean, that was a long life. That was she had a fabulous life.
She was in the bonus. That's for wonderful. Sure.
But it was interesting. Like there
How old was her will?
It was old, like from a typewriter old, obviously, like probably in the early 70s. And there were some things in there, like she had sold some land, and then we had inherited it, and then went and realized that it had already been sold. I mean, there were so many things in it, because it was so old.
Yes.
I mean, how often does someone need to update it?
Well, when there's a major change in life, like a remarriage, or birth of a child.
Or turn 100.
Turning 100, those are always a good time to update your will. Of course, acquiring property or selling property, like in your case, that gift in the will of the property to you and your relatives is actually a lapsed gift, meaning the gift's no longer there. It can't be made. It's a non-event.
Does that make the will invalid then?
No. No, it makes that gift.
That part.
That area of it. Yeah.
Right. That gift will never happen because the estate, the possessions in the estate formerly held by your grandmother cannot be distributed. They're simply not there.
And it was detailed, man. I mean, she's got all kinds of grandkids, and I mean, it was amazing how much she, how much thought she had put into it back then.
Well, she probably had an estate's attorney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she probably did. You're right.
Yes, it does matter quite a bit.
So in your mind, a person should spend more time in the getting their estate planning done correctly rather than maybe throwing money towards life insurance? If you were going to choose between those two.
Well, I wouldn't say don't spend money on life insurance. I'm not here to down the life insurance industry. They do a wonderful job, at least, of getting their products out there. No, on the other hand, the planning should be done, and often it's avoided in most cases. So it's just a point mainly to say your legacy, your family is important. Those mm-hmm. who come after you, you might want to be considerate rather than obtuse toward them,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Not paying attention to those issues that matter.
Yeah, for sure. So if people are listening now and they think, you know what, there's something to be said for being overinsured and underplanned, how can they reach you?
Oh, well, it's very easy. My MeyringFirm.com website, and that's my last name, MeyringFirm, firm, FIRM.com, has planning forms. It has information. We write quite a few columns and articles about these subject matters. There's several scores of columns there, articles that people can click on and look it up by subject matter. And we just relaunched our website to make that access to the information that's helpful to the family a little bit easier to
right.
acquire.
And is this something like if I decide I'm going to work with you, does it take months to do this, or is this something that I fill out some forms and we're good to go?
You start by filling out some forms, and we design the process to allow the client to be the slowest step in the process, meaning
right.
they can take the time that they need.
Sure.
We don't want to rush these issues.
Right.
There's an eventuality to it that I know it's going to be necessary eventually, so we just hope they can get the estate plan established in time.
Sure.
So it can take as little as it's taken less than 24 hours.
Oh, wow.
In the case of it's happened several times, people pass away within hours after
wow.
signing after signing a will or a trust. It's even taken cases longer than 2 years where people figured they weren't going to pass away. And
so what's our
just
hurry?
Take their time. Right.
They
mm-hmm.
take their time and they made it.
Oh, typically, is it something that takes weeks? If you want to do it in
on average, really, it takes 2 to 3 weeks.
Right.
If the client would be, you know, gung-ho, we would get it done in a week's time, quite typically. And we try to make ourselves convenient and available to people. We have a law firm right on Paces Ferry Road, almost right next to the railroad tracks in Vinings inside uh-huh. the perimeter.
So it isn't a scary experience. People shouldn't put it off.
No, it's not. We try to make the process as easy as possible, and that is the one biggest compliment that we get quite often is, wow, that was easy after they mm-hmm. signed their will. And honestly, we do realize that most people don't like to come to a lawyer's office. It's kind of like the dentist.
Really?
Yes, this is
maybe
true.
If you had video games, have you tried them?
Maybe. We haven't put those in yet.
The Wii.
Right, you need a Wii.
Yes, maybe we might. But we realize and we're sympathetic to the fact that people really, you know, they go to see their lawyers when there's distress, when
right.
there's issues to resolve.
Sure.
We're very sympathetic to that. We allow our clients to do most of their planning on the phone through emails,
right.
Such that quite often people come into our office one time to sign the documents. The meeting is a half hour long.
Right.
Everything's finished, and they have their final.
And then they walk home with the documents they need.
They walk home with the documents.
And they put it in their safe.
And then never look at it again.
And
they put it in their fireproof safe. Yeah, that's right.
Well, we have a copy, and we've had to produce copies before
sure.
for wills that can't be found.
Right.
And we just want to make it as easy as possible.
Right.
As easy as the life insurance industry has made it to get life insurance, we want to make it that easy to get estate planning.
That's
and
great.
No reason it shouldn't be.
And the website again?
Is MeyringFirm.com. And I would be the only Meyring in the Southeast.
So it should be
MeyringFirm. If you look up the seven letters, you will find me. You'll find the law firm and all sorts of other things.
Terrific.
But we'll keep that a surprise.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. Thanks for being our guest this morning.
Well, thank you Lee, and thank you for having us. We really appreciate the visit.
Sure.
And Anne, really, I would love to be your guest again. Just invite us anytime.
Wonderful. Right. Thanks for being Thanks. With us.
Great. Thank you.
That is so true, though, Lee. It is hard. It's one of those things that's kind of hard to talk about. But yeah. since you shared earlier that this government thing was a little, you know, still kind of had you, I'm not sure about it, we got to bring back another government guest.
Another one?
Yeah, two other ones.
I did not know that.
Sitting right in front of us. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show this morning, Dalton and
Jonathan.
Jonathan.
Good morning.
Jonathan Kloss. I asked you about that. I said, is it like Santa Claus?
She knew your last name.
Just the season, right?
Yeah, I didn't want to say in Mr. Kloss. Welcome to the Atlanta Business Radio Show, y'all.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Tell us about Main Street Technologies.
Well, at heart, Main Street Technologies is a software developer, and most of the products we've developed that have been very successful the last 5 years have served commercial banking throughout the United States. We're assisting with regulatory compliance and risk evaluation when it comes to lending and loaning money. And I know there hasn't been a lot of lending going on. One of your earlier guests alluded to the fact that especially small business lending has been very difficult to acquire the last couple of years, but there are tons and tons of loan portfolios out there among the various banks, about a little less than 8,000 nationwide, right, John? Mm-hmm. And there are a ton of issues now associated with properly reserving the calculating a reserve for all of these loans within a bank and also managing these loan portfolios. So our products have automated a lot of the very intricate processes in banking and help banks assess where they are as well as run some what-if scenarios in case certain things should change, economic factors locally or nationally, the experience of their lending staff. And these have been the real growth products for our company the last couple of years.
So if the banks had this, then they would have been able to tell the people didn't really have money a few years ago?
I would like to say that's the case, but I don't think that's the case. I think they could have better assessed where they were, a more accurate picture of the kind of situation that banking was in at an individual bank level. And one of the beauties of our products is that it's not a one-size-fits-all black box type solution. We actually install this in a bank
right
behind the firewall. It applies to their banking policies and the federal regulators and state
right.
regulators.
But it's only as good as the people using it, right?
Well, that's true to some extent, but it will show them where they're weak. It will show them where they have questions. It will reveal potential problems in right. their theories. And that's the beauty of it. Since it's automated, you can run a ton of scenarios and really test your assumptions and theories, check up on your employees, and see if they're doing what they should be doing without having to be a technical person, a computer guru, or even a very, very experienced banker.
All right. I need an example. I'm sorry, Lee, but I'm not getting it. So tell me about the products and services.
Let's
give us
a hypothetical. I'm Joe Banker. Is it like, do you work with like big banks, like the big, you know, Bank of America size banks, or is it the smaller, like, you know, Joe's Sandy Springs Bank?
Well, all banks range in size from $6 billion in assets and under. Bank of America is one of the 9 largest national banks.
Right.
So we don't serve any of those 9, but everybody else
it's
benefits.
Fair game. Right.
Right. And Jonathan has been, Jonathan Kloss is vice president of sales. He isn't sold this to banks throughout the country and in Asia. So I'm going to let him give you some examples.
Okay.
Yeah,
exactly. I mean, when we talk about the scope or the size client, I mean, it really spans the full gamut.
Right.
I mean, Bank of America, you know, we would welcome.
But they could use your product.
Absolutely.
They just don't have it yet.
In fact, right. as we continue to explore and we learn more about the marketplace and we learn more about the systems that banks are using, it doesn't matter if that's a small community bank or a large mega
right,
bank like Bank of America. There's, in a lot of sense, they're still using very manual processes. They're still utilizing those Excel spreadsheets,
really?
Believe it or not. Yeah,
wow.
Really? Yeah,
wow.
Exactly. And that was kind
that's
of
a little scary.
That was eye-opening to us as well. And
wow.
As we learn a little bit more about that and we talk about the risks that are associated with those manual processes with
right.
Excel spreadsheets. You know, there's so many different studies out there that talk about, you know, the percentage of error
mm-hmm.
In spreadsheets. You know,
right.
you know, on average, they say that 54% of every spreadsheet has at least one error.
Wow.
And
is it also something where in the bank there's only one guy that knows really what's going on?
It could be. You know? It could be. And there's a lot of shift in the banking industry right now as that experience is transferred.
Then the whole bank kind of shuts down if Tony's in the hospital.
That's exactly right. It could be anything. It could be the fact that you've got a senior credit official that is very good at what he does, and he's known for that, and he'll be shifted from bank to bank, you know, following the opportunities. So this
allows some more transparency and allows the sharing of information?
Absolutely. In fact, what we're doing here is we're essentially defining the policy for the individual institution, whether we're talking about the ALLL, which, you know, the allowance for loan loss reserves, which, going back to your first question, would, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, you know, this could have helped many of banks, as it would have allowed them to set aside enough capital to cover some of the downturn.
Or they would have been kind of at least had an awareness that, absolutely, hey, maybe we're pushing the limits here.
Yeah, exactly. When you automate the process, it's kind of hard to hide.
So there's a dashboard kind of component to this?
To an extent, yes. To an extent. It's a range of different solutions, whether it be for determining adequate reserves, or whether it be for ensuring the compliance to various regulations for problem loan reporting, or, you know, simple things like documentation perfection, which, you know, a lot of banks take for granted.
Right.
You know, it's some of those simple things that can have a tremendous impact, not to customer loyalty, enforcement actions. They have a negative effect on.
And it probably speeds up the process, I would imagine.
Sure,
also.
Absolutely. Efficiency gained. There's so many tangible and intangible benefits to that.
Are your clients, when you kind of make them aware that this is out there, are they kind of jumping on this? Is this something that they have to kind of go kicking screaming to?
It really ranges. It depends. It depends on the size institution. Some of the smaller institutions may see it as a direct expense versus a necessity.
Right.
And, you know, unfortunately, it's that's something that we have to continue to push on, is that, you know, it's not really a luxury. It's a necessity.
At this point, sure.
Exactly. When you're dealing even at a smaller institution, you've got these Excel spreadsheets, you've got one person that's doing it, there is no transparency. There are no there are no quality control checks, you know, that are in place. And these are things that automation brings to the table.
Right.
Exactly.
And Dalton, you started this company in 1999, right?
With a business partner, Michael Jones. He and I grew up together in the small town of Lakeland, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And in 99, we put together Main Street Technologies. And with the help of my wife, Margie Sermons, we have grown this from just the three of us to about 16 employees. And most of them are highly technical software developers, technicians, and sales professionals like Jonathan.
Was it always in banking? It was always around banking?
As a matter of fact, we started off with land record management systems, and we sold them in Georgia at the county level. Every county in Georgia has a superior court clerk that's charged with managing the real estate documents filed there. So we've worked on various state projects, and then individual counties have hired us to handle their land record management systems. And about a third of the state uses us right now on a daily basis.
Do they do it in a systematic way? Like, so every county does it the same exact way, or does every county kind of have their own system?
One of the things that that's fortunate about being in Georgia is back in the mid-90s, the Georgia Superior Court Clerks Cooperative Authority was formed. And all of these 159 Superior Court Clerks joined together in this authority to kind of pool some filing fees.
Right.
And then they set standards for real estate documents.
Oh,
and there's
wow.
been an ongoing project to re-index all real estate documents and create a statewide search. It's a one-of-a-kind authority, something the state should be very proud of. It's provided good opportunities for vendors like us, but it's been tremendous for the county governments.
Now, and other states don't do that?
We don't know of anything even closely like this,
really?
Maybe
wow.
in the state of Massachusetts.
So that's frightening.
Wow.
Isn't it?
Well,
I mean, you're in this business, you know, to have every county do their own thing, that's insane.
Yeah, it is.
And it's, you know, it's quite a coup for the state of Georgia because of how well they've done this, how well they've perfected this process and provided standards.
Because there's a million counties. To get them all to agree to this is pretty impressive.
Well, for 159 counties to all come on board and still maintain this as successfully as it's been maintained is wonderful. And it was really because of that. We had bankers and title searchers and attorneys in a couple of courthouses looking at records through our system. And we had a bank.
Oh, so you were really instrumental.
Well, we're one of a few of the players that were involved, right. But we had a bank call us and say, can you, and that's really how we started down the banking software 5 years ago. And as any other small business, you're always asking, what's next and who's next?
Right, and how to stay ahead.
Absolutely.
But how did you come up with the first concept in 1999? I mean, that's not
something. Was that a problem you were having? You're like, I can't figure this out. And you had to figure it out and you made your own software?
The problem I was having, as was my business partners, we were both in other careers. We were 35 at the time, and we were at a point in our lives where we decided we didn't want to stay on the path we were on, so we spent several weeks together determining what were our skills, how could we combine them,
right.
And develop a business where we had very little money to invest in it. And so we launched and earned this government contract. Individual counties assigned certain deeds for us to reindex. We used a remote model. We hired and trained people remotely to reindex these documents, and we literally operated it from a server in his dining room in Marietta with me on the road selling and Margie managing the little bit of money we had.
Unbelievable. Wow. That's a success story.
Yeah, that's a great story.
I love hearing things like that.
Well, so you found a pain, and then you made it go away.
And we took all of the what we earned from those projects and have reinvested
it back in the business.
Tried to grow the company. And,
so you did it old school.
Well, that with a lot of blessing from our Lord and you know, a lot of concern that it's just all paid out. And then when you find somebody like Jonathan Kloss, I can't say enough about this guy.
You've said a lot about him. So
yeah, it's good.
His head's getting a little big.
Well, what I'm trying to do is encourage you to take it to the next level.
Exactly.
Okay, so but you know, with any business,
I don't know, there's a lot of Jonathan Klosses out there. You know,
got to have super salespeople for anything to be successful.
Absolutely.
You're right.
Absolutely.
And how did you find him?
Is he related? Is this some nephew?
No family. He came knocking on our door 6 years ago, moving to the area, and. He wanted to talk about a job. I told him three different times there was no job, John. And he kept coming back with ways that he could add to the company and basically insisted we hire him in a very pleasing and persistent and not annoying way. And we saw no other choice but add him.
Well, if he can sell you figure he can sell other people. Right?
That's exactly right. You know, how many no's does it take for a guy to leave? And he never has.
Right.
So how do you go about selling?
Well, we
he's tenacious.
That's
we
right.
Know that.
That's right.
He's
we tenacious. Just have to beat the doors down. Now we market in a variety of different ways. You know, we do a lot of email marketing. We have built a list over the last 5 years of good composition of executive level folks throughout the country.
So and it's like bankers. That's all. The more bankers that, you know, the better.
The more bankers you know, the better. Exactly. It's still very much relationships.
Wow.
You know, the bankers talk to bankers, and we have to leverage those relationships. And we have great relationships with different federal regulators as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly helps.
Now, the bankers, are they only here in Atlanta, or they're all over the
world? No. Today we're in 26 states. We have one bank headquartered out of Hong Kong.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. And it continues to grow. The Loan Loss Analyzer is really our flagship product, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And this was launched in early 2009. So here we are a short 2 years later, you know, with a lot of growth due to the fact that we are combating, you know, a lot of those issues with the reserves. So
right.
So that's where our primary growth is today.
Were you guys shocked like this whole banking thing exploded the way it did? I mean, when I got my house, they made me jump through so many hoops of getting 20% down, and I had to sign away my life. I was an entrepreneur, so my tax records wasn't good enough for them, you know. And then I was finding out my sister, who was an elementary school teacher in Florida, she's like, our janitor is buying a block of 5 condos. I'm like, how is that possible? That this guy that's like a janitor at an elementary school is buying blocks of condos? I can't even imagine buying blocks of condos. I mean,
I think we saw behind the scenes that in many institutions that are no longer with us, you just had stacks and stacks of files on the floor. Documents were not properly filed. They weren't properly vetted. You had a lot of collateral that wasn't perfected. And then as long as appraised prices or appraised values of properties continue to increase, you know, everything was fine.
Right.
But when they started going down.
Yeah, when the music stops,
somebody's got to pay for it. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's provided great opportunity for us, but where we're the most proud is that we, in a small way, are kind of assisting
in
the recovery.
Right, you're cleaning this mess up.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean,
but there
helping.
But there are really good and talented bankers out there that that have suffered like the rest of us, and they're the ones that still remain, and they have a lot of work to do, and we're glad to be able to assist them.
Yeah. So when do you see this getting cleaned up anytime soon, or we're in for a while?
Well, you know, again, I'm not the the economist here, right. but I think we're on the upward right. swing.
You're talking to the banks. I mean, you can tell their mood. Are they in a good mood or a bad?
Recovery is going to be it's going to be a long period. Mm-hmm. Right. There's no doubt about that. But you know, I think again, regulation is a sensitive subject.
Sure.
But, certain aspects of that regulation, I think, are good. As we begin to crawl out of this, we will make certain changes from an operation standpoint, from a lending standpoint,
right.
that
mm-hmm.
will ultimately reshape the way we do business and the way we communicate with banks. But ultimately, I think it'll be better for the financial system. So,
right, sure. It'll be more true, right? Yeah. It'll be more integrity than the system.
Absolutely,
this will help. The software helps in that, right? Yeah.
But when you have economic recovery without mass job creation, we're in kind of uncharted territory. The housing right. industry will continue to suffer. The foreclosures will have to be sold at discount prices. The market's right. flooded with those. That means the values are continuing to decrease.
Right.
And it's just going to be a very interesting time. So strict regulation, good practices, solid methodologies are imperative to successful banking.
Yeah, it's back to the blocking and tackling. You got to do the fundamentals well, and
that's
good
right.
things happen. You know, when you start kind of that's cheating right. the systems, then you got to pay a price at some point.
That's exactly right.
Wow. Interesting concept. I love hearing how people start.
A great story. You guys should be proud.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you.
What's the best way for bankers, and I know you're not just in banking, but where can people learn more about what you guys do?
MainStreet-Tech.com.
And that's Main Street Technologies.
Yes.
Correct.
Right.
Wonderful. Thanks for being our guest today, Dalton and Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Great information.
Yeah, great show.
Gosh, Lee, I
do we learn something?
I learned so much
we
in 1 hour.
We should pay the guests.
That's right. We really
we're
should.
We're getting like an MBA. Something.
I feel like, some shows I walk away from it and say, what was that? Because it's language I don't even understand. But some shows like today, it's like, wow, that's a lot of great information.
Right.
And I love the motivational stories that people give to our listeners because people are looking for that. They want right. to hear success stories. And that last story, definitely a big success story.
Sure.
Until next week, I'm Amy Otto with the Atlanta Business Radio Show. Have a wonderful week.